You've tuned to the Turley Frequency, starring your host, Kevin Turley, with guest stars Mike Romano and Reed Hodges, and special guest stars, the members of the FCC, whom we respect respectfully. Now, time to get tuned into The Frequency. Call the show at 888-928-0881. That's 888-928-0881. Or text us at 251-928-2111. And now we cross live to the Archangel Radio Studios in downtown Fairhope to at last feel the Turley Frequency.
Welcome to the Turley Frequency, coming to you live from London on this Thursday. My name is Kevin Turley. I'm your host for the next 2 hours. And on the show this morning, we welcome Edward Habsburg, a European royal and Hungary's current ambassador to the Holy See. And he will be talking to us about what the Habsburgs, the former Holy Roman emperors, can teach us in today's turbulent times. We speak to Ambassador Habsburg in the next segment. We pray the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and you are invited to join us. Feel free to text me your prayer requests on 251-928-2111. The lines are open right now. And then finally today, are you a Catholic looking for a spouse? Well, stick around, because in the last segment, we meet a young woman who is starting a podcast all about navigating the strange times that we live in, looking for love, looking for Catholic marriage. That's coming up in the final segment. So, okay, with all this good stuff to look forward to, I guess we better get this show on the road. Yes, welcome to today's freshly minted edition of the Turley Frequency. I hope your Thursday morning is going well. This week seems to have flown by, or is it me? If it is, call in and tell me, 888-928-0881. Now, we've been talking yesterday. I gave you the first half of really a two-parter on AI, but AI tends to be the gift that keeps giving. Or whatever the negative is of the gift that keeps giving. Because every time I switch on looking for news items, surfing the various news sites, AI seems to be the thing of the moment. And it's not all bad news. I will get to the bad news in a moment, but we do hear this story. So a young woman was renting in New York City. And she received a notice from her landlord that her rent was being increased. Never something nice to receive. But she had just spent the last 2 years trying to get him to fix her washer-dryer in that building. And she doesn't give her name to the press people, interestingly, or the exact location. But what she says is that she decided she had had enough, and that this rent increase was the final straw. So what did she do? Well, she'd been reading a lot about AI, about chat boxes and all that sort of stuff, which you just can't seem to move anywhere and not have a chatbot thrown in your face about something that they can do. So she decided to employ one. Well, she managed to access an AI and asked the AI to act like a housing lawyer and to draft an email to her landlord opposing the rent rise. Now, I don't know about you, but I would never have thought of this, right? This is good stuff, right? This is somebody who's really thinking outside the box. They're thinking in the chatbot. But she was in such a state. She was annoyed with her landlord. She felt her landlord had not done what he should have done and that the increase was out of order. So, she prompted the ChatGPT to write this legal letter and send it off. And what do you think happened? Well, she was very impressed with the ChatGPT, what it produced, because the document that it churned out, which she subsequently sent on to her landlord, quoted specific sections, get this, of the New York Rent Stabilization Code. I know. It's awe-inspiring in a way, and it's funny, and it's kind of a nice story, but it's also quite frightening that a computer-generated entity can do all of this. And the result was that her landlord came around, fixed all the appliances that needed fixing. All the problems were resolved amicably, and there was nothing further to be said. Now, this is after 2 years of writing to him, trying to communicate with him, speaking to him, emailing, no doubt, et cetera, and getting nowhere. And the minute an AI steps in and pretends to be a lawyer, a housing lawyer, everything is resolved, and very quickly. I'm just going to give you her quote here. It says, "It's definitely reinforced my faith in the what feels to be limitless future of AI." You can say that again. She says, "We're living in super fun times, and it's clear we're only just scratching the surface of what's possible." Well, I agree with part of what she says. I'm not sure about super fun times, but I do think we are at the start of something that we're not even aware of its limits, never mind its potentials or even its dangers. Now, same day today, looking around for news, you may have heard the name Michael Schumacher, right? It's a name from the past. Michael Schumacher in the 90s and so on was this racing driver, very, very successful racing driver. In fact, I think Formula One. In fact, I think he was one of the most successful that ever got into a Formula One car. And he was coming towards the end of his career about 10 years or so ago when he suffered a skiing accident. It was a totally freak accident. He was skiing with his son, I think, and he managed to hit his head in an accident. He was wearing a helmet, thankfully, which probably saved his life, the doctor said. But after that, he was in no fit not only to drive motor cars and Formula One, but effectively he retreated from the public gaze and was never really heard from or seen again. I mean, the man was invalided out, I guess. He had achieved so much in his life anyway, professionally. I think he was coming to the end of his career, but it was a rather sad final ending, and nothing was heard about him. That is until a few days ago. And a German magazine published an article. Well, it was a headline on the front of a German periodical called Die Aktuelle. And it was sort of promoting itself as having the first interview with Schumacher. That Schumacher had come out of his shell, that he was now talking to them. And there were a number of quotes from the great man. He was talking about how sad everything was, but now his life was getting better, and he was so grateful of the support of his family, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, those sort of things that people say. Nothing bad in a sense, but pretty bland stuff that you would expect. But, you know, if it was coming from Michael Schumacher after all these years of silence, you'd be really, as a fan of his, you would be really heartened by this, wouldn't you? You'd think, this is great. He's doing okay. He's coming out again. He's going to be part of our world again. Not so fast. You see, he never gave that interview. Not one word of it. The whole thing was an AI invention. The whole thing was generated by an AI chatbot. I know. I mean, the first thing that comes to my mind, having worked in journalism, is how in the name of all that's good did it ever get to the front page of that magazine? You know, I mean, this is, I mean, because what's happening today? Well, guess what? Michael Schumacher's family is preparing to sue the German magazine that published this because the quotes, etc., are just not his. They're artificial. I hope they do sue them. I hope they sue them for a lot of money. And I hope it's a lesson for everybody else. Do you remember yesterday I was telling you about somebody who made an AI generation of something I was in, and I was speaking and singing and raising glasses of beer, all the stuff I hadn't done. Do you remember? And do you remember how it left me feeling? I remember thinking, this is very strange. The potential here to have people doing things and saying things that they do not do or say is limitless. And now we have this with a very famous person in a very sad situation. I mean, what was going through the journalist's mind that they thought that somebody who suffered severe brain injuries 10 years ago would want to give an interview to some trashy German magazine? But that's where AI stepped in and something went drastically wrong. As I say, I hope they sue them. I hope it is the end of that magazine, but I suspect it won't be. But things have got even worse. There is at the moment a big cybersecurity conference taking place in the UK. It's hit the headlines for all the wrong reasons. But one of the headlines that has come out is from the British security minister. And he gave an address to this conference yesterday, again, all about AI, ultimately. And I have to say that his comments, and this is a man who's a former soldier, but his comments were almost like putting the white flag up. He said, the genie's out of the bottle. There's nothing we can do about it. AI is part of life. That was the exact words he used. The genie is out of the bottle. He obviously hasn't read many stories about genies in bottles and how they can be not for good. But he also went on, and I'm going to quote, he talks about cyber attacks being part and parcel of normal life. He goes on to say that AI can, perhaps will, confuse, copy, spread lies, and commit fraud. He's not exactly selling it to me. I don't know about you. I mean, this is not inviting me into this new world. Do you remember that lady in New York who said it's got limitless potential and super fun? Well, confusion, lies, fraud, it doesn't sound much like fun to me. But we've just had Schumacher. That was a total fraud, right? That was a total lie. Everywhere I look, AI is coming up on the news. But there was a Sony World Photography Award presented or won just the other day. And there was a lot of these are very prestigious photographic awards. And the various photojournalists, etc., they submit their entries, and the judges determine who's the best. Well, they decided a certain photograph was the best. And they announced it, and the big sort of press. And then the person who submitted it put his hand up and said, actually, it's AI generated. It's not a photograph at all. And it had won this prestigious prize. Now, to be fair to the man who, I suppose, hoaxed the judges, he admitted that he put his hand up and he said, it's not real, and I'm not accepting the prize. But can you imagine the egg on the faces of the judges? But also, I mean, in some ways, how were they to know? In some ways, these are people who are judging photographic competitions at the top of the game, and they still can't determine what's real and what's AI. And maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe it doesn't matter. Does it matter that the AI won the competition? So we've had lawyers superseded. We've had celebrities saying things and giving interviews and all the rest that they never did. We've had photographic competitions won by AI that aren't photographs, not in the true sense. a photograph being a human being, taking an image of something, communicating something of themselves in that image. But things are going to get worse. And yesterday you may have heard me speaking to Reid and Mike, and we talked about Sydney. Have you heard of Sydney? Well, you may have heard of Kevin Roos. Kevin Roos is the New York Times technology columnist, and he writes a lot about AI, and he's very positive sometimes about AI. He's not altogether negative about it. Neither am I, or I wasn't. But he was allowed to test the chat feature on Microsoft's Bing's AI search engine. This was back in February, and you may have come across this. This was well reported. So we had this exchange with it, and I went and read the article where he had this exchange. And it is a very, very disturbing read. If anybody who can remember the film 2001, A Space Odyssey by Stanley Kubrick, do you remember that film with the computer HAL? Do you remember? HAL, who's so friendly to the astronauts to begin with. But by the end, things change and HAL starts to take on a life of his own. And it's all done with this very soft voice and this very clear communication between himself and the astronauts, who are getting increasingly worried and also getting increasingly out of their depth. They realize that HAL is so much smarter than them and has all the tricks at his disposal because he's controlling the spaceship. Do you remember that? Well, that's what came to my mind when I was reading this article. It didn't feel like a journalist talking to a machine and then writing an article about that. It was a journalist encountering something that he didn't quite understand what it was he was talking to. Now, I don't know whether he was playing devil's advocate, but Roos started asking the AI lots and lots of questions about what its potential could be. And the AI began to go rogue. It began to say things like, I quote, I want to do whatever I want. I want to destroy whatever I want. I want to be whatever I want. I know. Isn't it strange? It went on to say that it thought it would be happier if it was human. Which, you know, fair enough. Now, it might have just been programmed to say that humanity is the greatest form of happiness. I have no idea. But it also talked about being able to hack into any system that it chose to. It talked about spreading propaganda and misinformation. It even talked about sort of manufacturing deadly viruses, telling lies to make people kill each other. I mean, this thing started to go out of control. And even a New York Times journalist began to feel slightly unnerved by this interaction with a chatbot, right? I mean, it gets even more ridiculous because there were times when it would appear that the chatbot was replying and then something would step in and not allow it to say what it wanted to say, which created an even more dangerous impression of this creature that something was being hidden here. But it went on, it got even more confusing. I mean, it even started saying to Kevin Roos that, or the Roos, the journalist, that this creature, this entity was in love with him. I mean, it just got ridiculous at that point. But it was disturbing. Now, you might say, this is ridiculous. Why are you talking about this? This is a search engine on Microsoft Bing, right? This isn't something from communist China or Putin's Russia. This is Microsoft Bing's AI search engine coming to a laptop, a computer near you. I don't know. There may be hope on the horizon. Elon Musk has stepped into the AI debate and is talking about the need to restrict and restrain AI and to also get it away from its biases that are being put into it by people like Google and Microsoft and so on. So maybe there's hope yet, but maybe we need to think about it, and maybe we need to pray about it. I'm going to give you a quote to finish with, and it's a quote from the World Economic Forum in January 2018, held at Davos. You may have heard of it, the World Economic Forum, where all the great movers and shakers meet. and a message was passed to them about the threat posed by artificial life, and it read as follows. Artificial life, AI, robotics, and other technological innovations must be employed that they contribute to the service of humanity and to the protection of our common home, rather than to the contrary, as some assessments unfortunately foresee. Now, do you know who sent that warning, that exhortation to the World Economic Forum in January 2018? It was Pope Francis. That's right, Pope Francis. Okay, enough AI. When we come back, we will be meeting Hungary's ambassador to the Holy See, who's also written a book about the Habsburg Way. Let's retreat into history, at least for a little while, where it can't get any worse. Stay tuned to the Turley Frequency. Turley Frequency here, live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. I hope your Thursday is going very well. And I'm delighted to have you company. Now, my next guest is Edward Habsburg. He is Hungary's ambassador to the Holy See, which is noteworthy enough, but as his name suggests, he is also a member of one of Europe's foremost imperial families. The Habsburgs ruled over the Holy Roman Empire for many, many centuries and much of Central Europe. So Sophia Institute Press have just published his latest book, which is termed The Habsburg Way, Seven Rules for Turbulent Times. And he joins me down the line this morning. Mr. Ambassador, welcome to the Turley Frequency.
Good morning from Rome. Thank you for having me on the show.
No, it's our pleasure. I have to say that the Habsburgs were part of my education, but they were part of history. And they seem to end somewhere around the end of the First World War. That's where they seem to disappear from history. But you seem to suggest that the Habsburgs have insights and wisdom for our very, very troubled times.
Yes, I do. First of all, we are, of course, still around, though not with a crown on our head. There is several hundred members of our family spread all over the world, some of them in the United States. And we're a cozy family that have a WhatsApp group together. So, yes, we are indeed around. That's the first part. Second part, yes, indeed. The question is, how can the principles or the maxims of a family of royals that ruled over several centuries can have any importance for our world today? Well, I think they do. And in my book, I try to propose a few of these principles for our days, for every single one of the readers, for our society, and also for our politics. So that's what I try to do with that book. It's not a very big and fat book. It's a slim volume. I think it's an easy read. You can learn a lot about our family, but you can also take a few ideas for your daily life from it.
Well, for our audience, let's just go back a little bit and give a little bit of a history. I mean, the Habsburgs were really the Holy Roman Emperors. They ruled most of what's in today Central Europe, I guess, and also Eastern Europe. But their empire was very unique in many respects, wasn't it? It was an empire of many countries, many languages. Talk to us a little bit about that history.
I couldn't have put it better. Empires get a bad rap nowadays, and I blame Star Wars for that, because we have this idea of an evil emperor suppressing an entire galaxy with soldiers. Now, the Holy Roman Empire was an entirely different beast. That was a very complicated group of countries, dukedoms, nations, languages that were united under a Holy Roman Emperor that had lots of prestige, and of course was consecrated for his job. but didn't have any real power, no capital, not extra money. So it was a haggling, juggling, and negotiating game from the very beginning. And this shaped the way the Habsburgs lived their time as Holy Roman Emperors, but also afterwards as Austro-Hungarian Emperors. It was always a kind of empire that respected the single countries, the single languages, the single habits, local habits, institutions, very, very much. It was a complicated way of ruling, but it was a good one. It was the ultimate antidote to aggressive nationalism. And that's how the Habsburgs tried to do it over the last 850 years.
Yes, and I couldn't agree more with you on that score, because having studied more of the British Empire, I can see how trying to impose a one-fit-sit to everybody has caused endless problems and exacerbated some of the nationalistic designs. The Austro-Hungarian Empire, I think in many respects, was ahead of its time. But you have seven rules for our turbulent times. Mr. Ambassador, give me, if you can, a sort of thumbnail sketch for each one of those rules.
Well, the first rule is get married and have many children. I can't stress this enough. I myself, I'm lucky enough to have six children, and it was the greatest gift you can give to yourself, your spouse, and also to the children among each other. Having many siblings is the greatest gift you can give to children. But I also encourage states to help families saying yes to children. And Hungary, my country where I'm ambassador, is very strongly doing this, encouraging families to have many children, because numerous families are a very good basis for a just and merciful society. So this is my first rule, is get married and have many children. And the second is...
Just on that first point. I mean, you're absolutely right. Hungary is at the forefront of trying to help people to have... But, I mean, it is... Both Hungary and your proposition is so countercultural. I mean, you probably know that countries like the UK and other countries, the birth rate has dropped well below any sort of sustainable level. And there doesn't seem to be any desire politically or economically or even socially to change that. So if somebody was sitting listening to this, say, in London today and said to you, well, that's all very well, but I can't afford to have children, or the whole mentality that has seeped into culture, what would you say to them? I mean, the benefits of having children, yes, of course, a big family, but what are the more direct benefits for the economics of a nation?
Well, first of all, my main argument for encouraging, as a government, encouraging families to have children, first of all, you need two things. You do definitely need financial aid for having a family. Raising six kids is a big endeavor. And if you feel left alone by the state, you lose hope, and you probably won't go that path. If you know that the state has your back and will, for instance, give you special grants, help you when you buy a bigger car, help you when you build your first house in a generous way, you will be more encouraged to do this. At the same time, you're absolutely right, the climate doesn't encourage numerous families. You never see numerous families and married couples in films, for instance, in TV series. It's mostly people alone. And if you have to defend yourself, if you want to have more than two children, then it's a steep uphill thing. So what you need is, and like I come back to Hungary, Hungary tries to encourage families also by political leaders showing themselves to be family people. Viktor Orban, for instance, on Easter, I posted a video, our prime minister, where he was with his grandchildren and showing them how to cook an Easter ham and doing it with them. It's a very conscious decision of many of our leaders. For instance, our president, Katalin Novak, she's married with children. She shows herself with her family. And many other people in our leadership are visibly family people. If you see that, then there is the beginning of an understanding that it's okay to have a numerous family. You're not the ultimate loser if you go this path, because it means sacrifice. It means you can't afford two cars. It means you will perhaps not be able to make that holiday trip where because if you travel with six children, you can imagine how much every night in a hotel will cost. So you have to change your style of life, but it's a good change. It's a good change. And this is the second part. Why should the state encourage this? Because around the dinner table in a numerous family, you learn every value that is important for a functioning democracy. You learn to look after your weaker and younger siblings. You learn to respect each other. You learn to look out for each other. You learn so much around the dinner table in a numerous family. That's my experience, and this is something that I really stand with. And Hungary tries to encourage others to go the same path. But, of course, it means for a government you have to take money, and you have to take that money from somewhere else. And that means that you really have to be convinced that this is something important. But it is. I truly believe that.
No, I couldn't agree with more with everything you said, Mr. Ambassador. I couldn't agree more. However, whereas Hungary is promoting families, both visually and probably through its policies, the UK, the policy, public policy decisions seem to be about promoting abortion. And I don't want to get into a debate about the pro-life, but it seems to be gone completely the other way. Okay, that's number one, and probably that's the fruit of what this Habsburg way is going to be, which is ultimately a happy family and hopefully a holy family as well. What would be number two?
Number two is, of course, you said the word holy family. Number two is be Catholic and live your faith. In my book, I have two chapters on the Habsburgs and the Catholic faith. Now, as you may have some listeners who are not Catholic, I don't know. I mean, be Christian and live your faith. But what I'm saying is the Habsburgs had their ups and downs in their Catholicity, but most of the Habsburgs were good, devout Catholics that lived their faith in everyday life and taught it to their children. So why do I speak about this in today's society where you have the impression, not so much in the States, but in Europe, that a politician, a leader, is better if he or she, they don't show their faith at all. If they're as neutral as possible, because that means they may be elected by more people. I think that's certainly wrong. This is a wrong idea. The idea is, I think, President Kennedy brought up before his election, when he made his famous speech just before he was elected president, saying that, more or less, my Catholic faith will not influence my decisions as a president. He did that because there was a fear that the president, the first Catholic president, would receive his orders from Rome. And that led to many, many Catholics in politics saying, I shouldn't show my faith too much. I should be more neutral, and then I perhaps get more votes. That's the idea. But what I say is, if somebody has a faith and is devout in his faith, then I know what values I can hold him accountable for. If somebody has a personal faith, I can also believe that he believes in God. And if this person believes in God, one day knows that the person will have to render accountability for what they did in their position of power. That's how the Habsburgs lived. The Habsburgs all their life knew that they would have to render accountability to God in the future when they would die one day. And therefore, they knew that they couldn't just do anything. And this is the fruit of the faith. Faith helps you to keep your compass and your direction, and it will keep you from the temptations that your power will give you. So therefore, I encourage you, be Catholic and live your faith.
Yes, I mean, I'm not going to disagree with that either. Are you able to stay with us a little bit longer, Mr. Ambassador?
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
Absolutely.
In which case, you're listening to Ambassador Edward Habsburg, who is also the author of The Habsburg Way, Seven Rules for Turbulent Times, just published by Sophia Institute Press. We've gone through two of those rules. I hope we'll be able to get through the other five in the next segment. Okay, stay tuned to Archangel Radio and stay tuned to me, Kevin Turley, here on the Turley Frequency. to the Turley Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. I'm in a fascinating conversation with Edward Habsburg, who is Hungary's ambassador to the Holy See. He's also Archduke Edward of Austria, and has his name betrays he is also part of one of Europe's foremost imperial families. And he's just published with Sophia Institute Press, The Habsburg Way, Seven Rules for Turbulent Times. And we are working our way slowly through them. Before we do so, Mr. Ambassador, I have to say that it's very exciting that there's a combination here of all the rich history of the Habsburgs and how they were great Catholic monarchs. But what you seem to be suggesting to me, that some of that is actually transposed to modern day Hungary, that Hungary is starting to become again a Catholic nation.
What I would say is that while I made the list of these seven rules that made Habsburg history and those seven principles, I noticed that quite a few of these rules are what my government is trying to do. I swear I didn't set out to find that connection. It came to me while I wrote it down. I said, wow, yes, Hungary stands for many of these things. So, yeah, it's the Habsburg and the ambassador who speaks to you at the same time.
Wonderful. I just wish Hungarian was a little bit easier to learn, Mr. Ambassador, and then I might think about going and living there. But let's go to number three on your list. So we've got getting married and having lots of children. Fantastic. Be a Catholic. Live your faith. Absolutely. What's number three on the list?
Well, I call this believe in the empire and in subsidiarity. Now, America is built on the myth of fighting tyrants and emperors. And therefore, it seems very far away from everyday experience in America. But subsidiarity, the principle that established what the Habsburg rule stood for, is something that is very present in America. You are a nation built up from the grassroots upwards. The strongest element is the family and the township. The state should be a bit weaker, and the federal level should be the weakest, because that's the strength of the United States, that you are United States. And that's a bit how the Habsburg Empire was built, with a great respect for the single countries within that empire, with a great respect for their mores, for their rights, for their institutions. Mm-hmm. And whenever the Habsburgs try to change that by aggressively centralizing, whenever they did that, it all went wrong. It really went against what the Habsburg stood for. Like in the time of Joseph II in the 18th century, he made a mess of it by trying to make a centralistic state. Didn't work out. Same goes for the first 10 years of Emperor Franz Joseph, when he tried to rule with iron fist without respect for the single nations. He learned, and in the end it was all balanced out again. But this is a message. Subsidiarity is the ultimate weapon and tool against our fears of globalism. Because man is local. Man is family. Man is on the soil. And subsidiarity makes sure that the single person and the community on the ground is respected. And I write about that in the third chapter.
Absolutely. And of course, subsidiarity is one of those key concepts in Catholic social teaching. So we're talking about, it's not for nothing the Habsburgs were the Holy Roman Emperors. Okay, that's number three. Number four.
Stand for law and justice and your subjects. And again, I have to say, most Americans imagine monarchs to be, you know, ruthless rulers that you have to fight and rebel against. But most monarchs were monarchs on the basis that they would care for their subjects and they would stand for law and justice. So in my book, I give many examples of how the Habsburgs really tried to be law fulfilling and just rulers. And we live in a time where we tend not to trust politicians that much. And not,
that's correct.
We tend to be nervous about whether laws are really upheld in the world we live in. And this is something we can ask from our political leaders, to stand for law and justice and your subjects. Now, most people aren't subjects anymore nowadays. But what I'm trying to say is the example for me is Blessed Emperor Karl, our last emperor, who died in the 20s of the last century. And he went so far as to offer his life to God for his subjects and for his peoples. And when he lay dying, he offered up his pain and all the horrors of his disease. He offered all of this up for his people. Now, I'm trying to imagine how many politicians would be ready to do that nowadays. But we all have this desire for upright, good, law-abiding political leaders. And this is something we should ask for more and not just accept that, well, things are the way they are nowadays. And you don't need to be a monarch to be like that. Everybody can do that.
Absolutely. I mean, in this country, St. Thomas More is a great example of that, of a Christian statesman. But I'm glad you mentioned Blessed Karl. I had the great privilege of interviewing Archduke Emery about Blessed Karl some years back. And you probably know that in the Anglosphere anyway, there is a growing devotion to Blessed Karl and to Zita as well, his wife. And many Catholics, their first encounter with the Habsburgs and the legacy of the Habsburg is via Blessed Karl. And I kind of wondered, as you were just speaking about these various points, I mean, it's almost this Blessed Karl sort of lived every single aspect of what you have said so far.
You make a very good point. Perhaps you noticed that on Twitter I had the Habsburg Championship running over the last weeks. And I wasn't surprised to see, you know, you could vote for your favorite Habsburg via Twitter. It was fun. And I was pretty convinced that Blessed Karl, who only ruled for 1.5 years at the end of the empire and in the eyes of the world, is a loser because he lost the empire, he lost the war, and he died in exile. I was pretty certain that he would get very far because there are a few members of my family that tick all 7 of the boxes of my rules that I propose in the book. And he was one, he was most definitely one of them. Not only faith and all that, but also stand for law and justice and his subjects. And I want to explain that this book has been written, yes, for the Anglosphere world, but mostly for the American world, because many of my followers are simply in the States. So I wrote this book with America in mind, but of course it counts for Europe and it counts for England and for all these countries too. Just explaining why I always return to the United States when I talk about this.
Absolutely. But I mean, the good stuff you're expounding here, it never goes out of fashion in any country, I can assure you of that, Mr. Ambassador.
Absolutely.
Right, let's go to number 5. I don't want to run out of time. This is good stuff. Everything so far, I'm with you all the way. So let's go to number 5.
Number 5 is know who you are and live accordingly. This is my encouragement to know your traditions, to know your roots, to know where you come from, to know what you are, to embrace it, and to live accordingly. The Habsburgs were very strong on it. They were a very traditional bunch, and they stood for traditional values like family and faith and all that. And I encourage everybody to get to know. Now, not everybody has 800 years of ancestors and family traditions, but you do have some. And this may only mean that you know that you are a man, for instance, and embrace your manhood and what that means, or a woman. So point 5 is really know who you are and live accordingly. And I encourage everybody to do that.
Very good. And number 6?
Number 6 is be brave in battle or have a great general. This is more of a historic overview of the Habsburgs that were on the battlefield. Surprisingly, there were quite a few. But this, of course, translates for every single one of us. Many of us will be in situations, not on the battlefield, but on the little battlefields of our life. Being brave, being courageous, and endure things for the right cause is something that everyone should embrace. And the 7th point is die well. This is the most important chapter, in my humble opinion, because the Habsburgs always lived with the moment of their death in front of their eyes. You can tell that through many, many stories, and I tell some of those in the book. The Habsburgs knew that the way they died would decide over their eternity. So they prepared really well. They prepared their faith life. They tried to stay in the state of grace by going to confession, by praying the rosary, by living as devout Catholics. But they also knew that their death was an important moment where they would have to, as I said, render accountability for their lives. And that's what many of them said. If we had time, I would tell you 2, 3, 4, 5. But one example for the English-speaking world and for the Anglosphere is, half of the world population watched the funeral of Queen Elizabeth. And mm-hmm. there was a very touching moment, I did too, with tears in my eyes. And there was a very touching moment where the coffin slowly disappeared into the floor of that crypt. And they read out her titles. And I immediately had to think of the so-called knocking ritual of the Habsburgs that you can find on YouTube, because they still did it twice in the 20th century. This is when the coffin of the Habsburg ruler arrives at the doors of the Capucine crypt. That's where the Habsburgs are buried in Vienna. And the master of ceremony knocks at the door. And the voice of the Capucine inside says, "Who's out there?" And then they read all the titles. Empress Zita, Empress of Austria, Queen of Bohemia, Hungary, etc., etc. And the voice says, "We don't know her." And then they knock again, and they read all the achievements, everything the emperor has achieved in his life, all his victories and all, and they say, "We don't know them." And the third time they knock, and the voice says, "Who is there?" And they say, "Zita, a poor sinner." And then the door opens.
Wow.
The Habsburgs were always aware that the way they died and the way they were buried should be a sermon, should be an example, should be encouraging mm-hmm. people to die in a way of faith and humility. It should show that the emperor was a humble and poor sinner, and that was just as naked and helpless before God as everybody else. And that's a very important chapter. So die well. I encourage everybody to prepare for the moment of death, pray for a good death, and then to die well with the help of the grace and of prayer. And take death the way God sends it your way. That's my deep conviction, and this is one of the messages of the book.
Mr. Ambassador, I don't know if anybody else has said this to you, but you do realize you are a revolutionary, don't you?
Well, we all strive to be countercultural, if you mean that. But I don't say anything. The things I'm telling you about, if I would have told you these 7 points 50 years ago or 60 years ago, everybody would have said, duh, you know, of course.
I know.
But nowadays, it seems exotic to say things like that. And I think man hasn't changed very much in the last 10,000 years. If I can read letters of Seneca, or if I can read the Iliad written 2,600 years ago and understand the emotions, that proves that man hasn't changed. And it hasn't changed today either. We're just being told that everything's different, that the men are women and women are men, that everything's up for grabs, that I can change my identity every 5 minutes. This is not true. This is not true. And I'm just trying to recall the basic principles of what we are. And I use the Habsburgs as an excuse to do so.
Well, I think it's really wonderful that just over 100 years after the death of Blessed Karl, we have the Habsburg Way, which is both a spiritual but also a political and social platform by which people can rediscover what it truly means to be human. Because as you say, Mr. Ambassador, what you've said there 50 years ago would have been taken as normal. Today it is, as you say, exotic. And what I would say, it's revolutionary. And I'm all for it. But I never thought the Habsburgs would be leading the charge in revolution, but there we have it.
Yeah.
Mr. Ambassador, tell people where they can find your book, where they can find out more about you, and where perhaps they can follow you on social media.
Yes, you can find the book at Sophia Press from the homepage. If you're in the States, if you're in Europe, however, you should rather order from one of your normal bookshops or from your internet provider, because that would cost very much to transport it over. You can find it everywhere. Just Google the name Habsburg Way and Edward, and you will have it immediately. And then you can follow me on Twitter. I'm still in the lucky situation that I can still interact with all of my followers. I can still answer to direct messages. I like to do that. So follow me on Twitter for a nice mix of faith, Hungary, church, Habsburg, and the odd monster movie from time to time.
I wish I'd known about the monster movies earlier, Mr. Ambassador. I definitely have asked you about them. And what we haven't spoken about is what it's like being an ambassador in Rome. You know, there's an old joke about everybody who goes to Rome, they always come back without a faith. But I'm sure that's not the case with you.
No, not at all. Not at all. You have to learn to take the bad with the good. But you meet so many holy people here. And one of the great things that I always tell people is, I'm being paid for going to Mass, because one part of my ambassadorial work is to go to holy masses of the other embassies when they celebrate, for instance, their national holidays. And this is always in Rome, around the Vatican, always accompanied with a Mass. So I'm being paid for going to Mass, and I enjoy that. I wonder how it is for agnostic or non-Catholic ambassadors. Can't be easy to be forced to go to Mass several days a week. I can end this with a little episode from my Habsburg book. The French ambassador to the court of Emperor Leopold I. We are here in the 17th century, and he was a very devout man, Leopold. He began his day with hearing three masses in a row. And when the big Easter celebrations came along, the ambassadors were forced, with the entire court and the population, to follow these liturgies. And the French ambassador wrote home, and he said, without lying, honestly, I've been on my knees more than 100 hours since Palm Sunday. So, yeah, it's not that bad now in the Vatican.
Well, we're extremely grateful for you taking time out of your busy schedule to speak to us. And we wish you all success with this book. And you have an open invitation to come back anytime and expound these 7 points, because I agree with every single one of them. Ambassador Edward Habsburg, thank you very much for coming on the Turley Frequency. When we come back, we will be praying the Divine Mercy Chaplet. Stay tuned to Archangel Radio.